Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Supreme Court says a big class action suit is actually too big. The nation's mayors say they are still in economic trouble. And the Egyptian economy on the broadcast today, red tape and black markets. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day on the web at manta.com. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at chevyvolt.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, today the 20th of June. Good to have you with us. The class action case in question this morning at the Supreme Court wasn't just your run-of-the-mill lawsuit. Had the justices agreed with a lower court ruling, it would have been the biggest such case ever. 1.5 million women across the country, current and former employees of Walmart, would have been eligible. It was a gender discrimination suit, and I say was because it's now in the past tense. Customers of tobacco and oil and pharmaceutical companies, among many others, have used class actions successfully. But now things could change after this ruling. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has the story.
Organizers of this class action claimed Walmart's pay and promotion policies in every store nationwide favored men. But the Supreme Court decided the small group of women who filed the class action didn't share the same status or circumstances with 1 million or more other Walmart workers. Michael Droke is a labor lawyer with Dorsey & Whitney.
The court says that there really has to be some common issue of fact, and in particular a common injury.
Today's ruling, he says, will shield large corporations from massive class action lawsuits that would be costly to defend.
It is unquestionably harder for large groups of plaintiffs to bring these types of cases now.
Brendan Burke is a labor discrimination consultant. He still expects to see smaller, more targeted class action lawsuits from corporate employees.
Instead of one large, giant lawsuit in this case, a number of smaller lawsuits, let's say, filed on behalf of, you know, store managers or assistant store managers. So you'll see a number of smaller lawsuits with more commonality.
Burke says smaller class actions are usually easier to prove, since judges and juries can see how corporate wrongdoing hurts individuals. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
As happens every year when the court's term winds down in mid-June, it's handing down rulings about as fast as they can be printed. Some of the country's biggest electric power companies got a win at the court today. The justices unanimously rejected a lawsuit that would let states sue utilities over global warming emissions. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
This suit pitted half a dozen states, New York City, and some land trusts against some of the biggest coal-burning utilities in the country. Plaintiffs wanted the right to sue those utilities for greenhouse gas emissions. They argued those emissions were a federal nuisance, so federal judges could order power plants to cut them. But the court didn't buy it, says Bruce Myers at the Environmental Law Institute.
Basically, the court says Congress has left it up to EPA under the Clean Air Act to regulate CO2 emissions.
But it's unclear how rigorously the EPA will restrict those emissions. Bill Fang is an attorney with a utility trade group. He fully expects the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases despite congressional and corporate opposition. But he says groups like his are lobbying the EPA for more flexibility, and intense lobbying has already gotten the EPA to delay draft rules on power plant emissions. State regulators, Fang says, are applying pressure as well.
I think they're very concerned about the effects of further regulations in terms of cost impacts on customers.
Today's Supreme Court ruling did leave one important question unanswered: whether state courts can decide such cases. Corporate attorneys argue these kind of climate change nuisance suits are, quote, equally flawed under state laws. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And this little tidbit from the Marketplace desk of ominous political ambiguity. Arizona Senator John Kyle is among those who've been in on the debt limit negotiations with Vice President Joe Biden. The group has imposed a deadline of July the 1st on itself for some kind of deal. But Kyle said today that if they can't come to an agreement, they will have to, and these are his words, reassess the situation. Kyle didn't elaborate, but you do have to believe it means we are going to be doing debt limit stories all year long. Wall Street Today was up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a big meeting of mayors in Baltimore, Maryland today. It's the U.S. Conference of Mayors, to be precise. They're meeting with the president to talk economy, what they're doing to create more jobs and get things going again. A new report the Mayors Commission shows metropolitan areas account for about 86% of all the jobs that we have, and that cities aren't creating jobs fast enough. John Dickert is the mayor of Racine, Wisconsin. The report says his city's unemployment levels, rather, won't get back to where they were before the recession until 2015. Mr. Mayor, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
What's your sense from the Racine perspective, if you will, of the report that came out of the conference this morning?
Well, Racine is a steel town, a heavy industrial manufacturing town. We've seen pretty much the brunt end of this for decades. Racine has either been first or second unemployment in the state of Wisconsin for almost 20 years. You know, you're a city that used to have tens of thousands of jobs in manufacturing and light industrial, now all fallen away to where the plants where those jobs were don't even exist anymore. So we went from, when I started 2 years ago, we had 17.5% unemployment. We've been working with companies and trying to create a good opportunity for growth in Racine. We got it down as low as 12.8 about a month ago, and it dipped back up after the governor's budget came through to about 13 or 14.
So when you go out down to Main Street in Racine and you have breakfast with your constituents at the cafe there, what are they saying? What's the mood about the economy?
Well, I think the mood is cautious. I've toured 31 businesses in my city, and most of the manufacturing that I've talked to has either hired back or is about to hire back everyone that they've let go over the last 2 years. However, they're not going to be bringing back any more than they have to. And that is because of the cautious nature, I think, of the country right now.
Yeah. Along those lines, are you seeing some of the really depressing parts of long-term unemployment? Are you seeing young people leaving, finding new jobs, and not coming back, that kind of thing?
Not necessarily. What I'm seeing is what every mayor deals with every day is when somebody comes up to you and says, "Mayor, do you have a job?" You know, I used to be a middle class, $70,000 a year wage earner, and now I've got nothing. I've been looking for a year and a half, and there's nothing there. That's the difficulty. So what we do in Racine, and one of the reasons our unemployment has dipped, is because we've been working with industries to find out, first of all, how we can make it easy for them to expand and grow, and more importantly, how we can create those partnerships to grow.
Give me the sales pitch. When you go to try to get a company to establish a plant or a manufacturing center, whatever it is in Racine, what do you tell them?
Well, I meet with about 3 to 4 a week, and what I tell them is, first of all, what can we do to get you here? What's the asset that we have that is most valuable to you? More importantly, what we do is we wrap all of our plans around each individual company. There's no cookie cutter approach anymore to economic development. We understand that the marketplace demands that, you know, they will be taking what we can give them and then going out to another county, another state, or another country and kind of bidding us out against each other. But at the same time, you know, we have assets that I think a lot of communities would love to have, which is the Great Lake, clean beaches, beautiful quality of life, and centrally located with a good market. So we try to really wrap our packages around each company, and some of these projects work, and some of them don't. But we keep trying, and I'm never going to stop trying until I get that unemployment number down.
John Dickert, the mayor of Racine, Wisconsin. Mr. Mayor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much. It was great talking to you today.
We hear stories all the time about how valuable our personal information is, how companies can use how we browse the internet or what we record and watch later with our TiVos to somehow make money. What if they can actually know how we spend money? Would that help? A certain set of companies already does, the ones who issue those little plastic charge cards we all carry around with us, and they are discovering the joys of data mining. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Banks and credit card companies know a lot about us. Where we shop, how much we spend, and what we buy in real time.
We know when they're shopping at Starbucks at 8 a.m. on a specific day.
That's Jim McCarthy, head of products for Visa.
before that card comes back to you from the barista, your phone will buzz and you'll have an offer. Could say, like, literally go next door and, you know, there's a cake sale at the bakery.
And you'd probably want that cake because the offer isn't random. It's part of a new electronic coupon program. Cardholders opt in, Visa analyzes their purchase history, and sends them offers tailored to their spending habits. Banks are doing it too with the plastic they issue, and merchants are willing to pay big money for that information.
Banks are under a lot of pressure to recoup lost revenue.
Ron Shevlin is a banking products analyst with the Aite Group. He says banks and card companies could make billions of dollars a year selling this information. And if this sounds a lot like the data mining Facebook and Google do, it is. But Shevlin thinks the data the banks and card companies have is worth a lot more to merchants.
At the core of this is the difference between behavior and implied intention.
Translation. Google and Facebook can tell advertisers what we seem to be interested in. Banks can tell merchants what we actually buy. Companies have cropped up to analyze spending patterns and connect banks with merchants. Rod Whitman heads product management at one such company, Cardlytics. It's working with more than 100 banks, as well as merchants like Macy's, The Body Shop, and DirecTV.
They can target based on a zip code, store name, the number of times somebody shopped, or the amount of money that somebody has spent.
Those customers will get a coupon once or twice a week via text message, email, or when they check their bank statement online. With this new data mining, banks can help merchants in two ways: identify their best customers and reward that loyalty, and help merchants poach new customers from rivals.
This product here is called Fix. It's our top-selling product.
Dan Obigi is the CEO of Dermstore.com, a Los Angeles-based company that sells skincare products. It spends about $1 million a month on ads, much of that online. Obigi's starting to shift that effort to bank coupon programs. He says more than Google and Facebook, data from the banks will help him reach customers who are buying face cream from rivals.
We're saying, look, you're buying at our competitor stores. We know that you're a great customer. We want you to come shop for the same thing you're already shopping for from Dermstore.com.
Cardlytics says about 20% of consumers opened the electronic offers they got from their banks, and 30% of them used the coupons. Success like that is almost unheard of in advertising. Merchants pay for that success only when a customer uses a coupon, a fee the data company splits with the bank. But just how smart are these ads? That I thought I'd see for myself.
The first four gifts we would recommend for you, and I'm ready to unveil those now if you're ready.
I'm ready. Should I be?
That's Mike Linton, marketing executive for data analysis company Free Money. He took my credit card statement and used Free Money's software to make me some offers he hoped I couldn't refuse.
So the first gift would be $15 at Foot Locker.
Well, okay. I'm a runner, and I actually really do need new shoes.
Followed by $20 at Pottery Barn.
Huh. I just moved from L.A. to New York, and I've been buying lots of housewares. And I still do need a bedside table and a shower curtain and a desk chair.
$20 at Lord & Taylor.
I will also need to buy clothes for weather we have in New York that they don't have in L.A., like winter.
Followed by $5 at Quiznos.
Interesting. I recently used my card to get lunch at Rival Subway. So, verdict. I'm not sure these offers have me running to the stores, but this is all stuff I need right now, and they're from places I haven't visited in a while. So now, I just have to figure out if I'm the kind of girl who likes her bread toasted, or if I prefer the sandwich artist touch. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, the new Egypt is facing some old obstacles.
People cannot afford the very high transaction costs that it takes to deal with the bureaucracy in any way.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets climbed higher today on European promises to help Greece avoid a default. We'll see how that one goes. The Dow Industrials added 76 points, almost two-thirds of 1%, ended at 12,080. The Nasdaq put on 13 points, about a half percent. 26.29, the number there. The S&P 500 advanced 6 points, about a half percent, 12:78 at the bell. One worrisome note, volume was kind of weak today. It signaled the market's doldrums may not yet be quite over. Health stocks came out ahead. Aetna and Humana each packed on around 3.5% today. Financial stocks did, so-so. Some, like Morgan Stanley, lost ground, closed down almost 2%. Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase each lost around 0.75%. Whole Foods bulked up more than 2% today on an analyst upgrade. Walmart bumped up 0.4% after that favorable Supreme Court ruling we told you about up at the top of the program. And the program, by the way, it's Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's Magazine, providing market ideas and insights to help readers manage their investments and protect their financial well-being. Online at Barron's.com. And by Novo Nordisk, for nearly 90 years, committed to innovation in diabetes care. Learn more at NovoNordisk-US.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at JaguarUSA.com. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve convenes a two-day meeting on interest rates and the economy. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on cybersecurity and data protection in the financial sector. And actress Jane Russell was born on June 21, 1921. She starred in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and many other films during her lifetime. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad gave a big speech at Damascus University today, his third since the protests started last month. It was the first time, though, that he has directly mentioned the economic consequences of continued unrest, but he did it in kind of a backhanded way. Most of the problems, he said, are psychological. That is small solace to the tens of thousands of Syrians who've decided or who've been forced to leave the country. Most of them have gone to Turkey, which is where Marketplace's Elisa Roth has been reporting the past couple of days. Hey, Elisa.
Hello, Kai.
Tell me what you're seeing there on the border, would you?
Well, here on the Turkish side, the government has set up a couple of camps for the so-called official refugees, the ones who've been registered, who've said they're here and that they want to stay. These camps are being run by the Red Crescent. They're actually not letting journalists in, but I talked to bunch of refugees and locals who have been in, so they're being housed in these small white tents that you actually can see for miles. They get fed three meals a day. There's medical care. There's a mosque. There's apparently a refugee imam who's been providing pastoral services to people. But there are also a lot of unofficial refugees here. These are people who are just living informally with friends or family on this side. In one village here, I met 30-something Syrians who had been divided up among four Turkish families. And their situation is pretty precarious because the Turkish families they're living with are pretty poor. And two of those host families told me that they actually weren't sure how much longer they could afford to feed all these people.
Yeah. What about the place you can't go into Syria on the other side of the border? What's it like there? Do you know?
Well, by far, I think the refugees on that side are the worst off. I've heard that there's anywhere from 5 to 10,000 of these internally displaced people. They've fled their homes. They're living in sight of the border in these tent cities. And standing on the Turkish side, you can see these blue tarps and cardboard structures that they've built just out in the open. Now, security-wise, the Syrian forces have reportedly been advancing toward the border. So that's scary, obviously. But there's also really just no infrastructure. I heard that Syrian forces have burned down the bakery that was supplying bread to all those people. And I actually have seen quite a few Syrians who sneak into Turkey to buy bread and other provisions and then sneak back across the border.
You mentioned this family who's housing these unofficial refugees, if you will. Who is paying the bill for all this? Do you know?
Well, in that case, you're just talking about the families are footing the bill. The camps are being paid for by the Turkish government. Now, there may come a time when Turkey decides that it has to ask for help from the international community. But for the moment, Turkey's really making a point of handling this crisis itself. It's also trying to tread gently around what has been until recently a very close relationship between Turkey and Syria.
Yeah, well, that question about how long it will last. There comes a point in every refugee crisis where the host government says, okay, we can't do it anymore because the people are getting upset about people coming in and taking jobs. How long is that going to last? How long do we have till that happens, do you think?
I think nobody knows the answer to that question. I think it's going to depend in part what happens in Syria, how many more people come over. I spoke to the mayor of one of these border towns who said, you know, right now my town has been almost doubled in population. That's fine. We can handle it. But if you start talking about, you know, quadrupling, quintupling, that's not going to work. At a personal level, the immediate response of just about everybody I spoke to is, this is family, and of course, we'll do whatever it takes to help them. And in a lot of cases, that's literally true. These are cousins and uncles, and, you know, it's a border region. People live on both sides of the border. And so they've been very generous. But there is some anxiety about what's going to happen. If you ask, you know, a few more questions, you get answers like, the Syrians are only coming here because they think they can find jobs. Mm. And, you know, other more practical questions, like, they already have water shortages in this region. So, you know, how can we support another 6,000 people on our water system?
Marketplace's Elisa Roth on the Syrian-Turkish border for us. Elisa, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Quick footnote before we go on about that interview with Elisa. This is the 15th straight week of protests in Syria. And I don't know if you remember, but a lot of the protests elsewhere in the Middle East, Egypt being one example, didn't even last that long and yet still managed to change the government. Now, though, Egypt is trying to figure out what happens next, how to build a completely new political and economic framework. Part of that has to be somehow getting jobs, or better jobs, for millions of people. Our series, Economy 4.0, is all about that, how to make the global economy work better for more people. So today, our special correspondent David Brancaccio reports from Cairo that, in Egypt anyway, the road to success goes through a very robust bureaucracy.
Reham Mohammed is frazzled.
I can actually see that nothing changed after the revolution. The people are still the same.
It's day two of Reham's long and winding road for registering with the government what should be a simple change to a business contract for her little company. She imports and exports medical supplies. She's inside this one-stop shop in Cairo, a catch-all government building for getting various business permits. It's like the DMV, clerks in little windows, take a number and wait. Only it's not minutes and hours, it can be days and weeks.
The system is still the same, the procedures are still the same, so nothing changed.
The thing is, unless Egypt untangles the red tape, it may never produce the private sector jobs it needs to bring stability and prosperity to the country. Jobs like the ones Hesham Abbas provides at his little boutique hotel called Invitation off Cairo's central square.
Okay, so tell me, so this is a typical room?
This is a typical room, yeah. All the rooms with air conditions, with TV, satellite.
The place is a deal at $22 a night, including breakfast. He employs 23 people, mostly young folks in college or just out of school. This is a medium-sized business, what experts say may be the future of the private sector. Yet the bureaucracy is killing him. When Abbas wanted to apply for a government loan specially targeted to help tourism-related companies like his, he couldn't get an appointment with the director. He called, he emailed, he sent faxes.
12 faxes.
12 faxes.
Because he refused to meet me for 3 months.
Abbas says he had to threaten to sue just to get the chance to make his case for the loan. So here's the crux, according to Raghi Assad, a fellow at the Economic Research Forum in Cairo. Too many business-minded Egyptians look at the hassle, the heartache, and sheer waste of time involved and decide not to register their business.
Many people simply cannot afford to do these things and so avoid them altogether and remain under the radar.
Assad says you can call it the black market or you can call it the informal economy.
This is the issue of informality. Informality is not that people don't want to pay taxes. Informality is that people cannot afford the very high transaction costs that it takes to deal with the bureaucracy in any way.
They keep their businesses small and on the lowdown, like this man selling little robot toy cats on a Cairo street. It's a small stand run by Amin El-Shanoi. just one man and his made-in-China toys that he sells for roughly $2 American apiece. And by staying small, they don't create enough desperately needed jobs. One advocate for formalizing, the process by which an unlicensed toy vendor becomes, say, a legal chain of robot toy stores that hires lots of Egyptians, is renowned economist Hernando de Soto. He sees the frustration of people in the informal economy as a driving force behind the changes sweeping the region. De Soto reminded us about Tunisia and the tragic story of the man credited with starting the Arab Spring by setting himself on fire. He was a man who worked in the informal market, selling fruit from a small cart.
What makes this interesting is that the whole revolution is set off by informals, people who work outside the legal system and who would like to work in a legal system that supports them.
De Soto argues that this isn't a revolution just of students, it's a kind of street vendor revolution, an uprising of people left out of the formal economy, he says. For stability to come to Egypt, it'll have to leverage the revolution to make it much easier for informal businesses to go legit, to come out of the heat, to register, get insurance, raise investment capital, and in that way create millions of private sector jobs. In Cairo, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. By Cargill, working with customers around the world to connect ideas to opportunities across food, agriculture, finance, and industry. Information at Cargill.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, soon to be for sale, the Los Angeles Dodgers. Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig has rejected a $3 billion TV deal between Fox Sports and Dodger ownership. If you've been following the sad story of the boys in blue and the divorce that team owners Frank and Jamie McCourt have been going through, you know this pretty much means the team's going to be up for sale by about the end of the summertime sometime. McCourt and his wife have been accused of taking hundreds of millions of dollars out of the team and using it for their own lavish lifestyles. Lavish is really the only word for it. Dodgers, meanwhile, 7.5 back in the NL West. And that's all we got. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Monday. Today, the Dow added 76 points, almost 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ put on 13 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 advanced 6 points, 0.5% there as well. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here.
Look at everything humane and everything social. You found it started in Egypt.
That may include overcrowding as well. Another Economy 4.0 story from the Middle East coming at you tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.